Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
The psalmist reminds us at the same time when we are comforting the bereaved that they have lost someone and that the person is not coming back, at least not in this world. And it brings back, it sort of retrieves the reality of the finality of death. It's the same thing when you place earth into the casket and the family goes first and they hear the thud of the earth on the casket. They realize at that moment that this person is not coming back. And so it's like the thud on the casket at the cemetery that the psalm is read in the home of the bereaved. Because the message is very clear. And this person said it may be a necessary balance. And maybe there's wisdom in that. It's an interesting thought. But as you will see, absent that answer, it's hard to justify why this would be at the home of bereavement. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. All right, one, Rick, hands up.
But verse 16, Rabbi.
Wait a second, I'm going to get there.
Verse 16 makes it all better, no?
Yes.
No?
Because you're going to see, it's nobody understands why that's there. It's totally contrary to everything else in the psalm. So we'll see. All right, we'll talk about that. Okay, Tybel.
So just because Rick jumped to 16, I'm going to go to 1 and ask if you can tell us about who the leader is and how many leader psalms there are.
Ah, you're talking about the, that was exactly what I was going to do.
Ooh.
I'm going to read to you Rabbi Siegel's introduction to this psalm, because it relates to the Korachites, B'nai Korach. Of course, Korach we know, right? He's a bad guy, right? He is a demagogue. He was killed along with 250 of his supporters who brought strange fire up to, the Mishkan. And as well, the people who were swallowed up by the earth. So I don't know if you realize that in that chapter, I believe it's chapter 16 of the book of Numbers, there were two modes of death. The famous one is this earth swallowing up the households of these people. But we also read that 250 of Korach's followers, they were Levites, were the ones who brought that fire. They were tricked, basically, by Moshe and Aaron to bring the fire. God told Moses to do this. Tell him to bring fire. On that basis, it's strange fire. And so God punished him with having fire come down and consuming them. So there were two punishments there. Korach was one of the guys behind this whole thing. Probably the leader, in fact. So now suddenly you have B'nai Korach, his descendants apparently, who are Levites and senior Levites who are creating psalms and perhaps singing them for the people in the temple. Isn't that strange? So nobody can fully explain that. But I'm going to read to you now what Rabbi Siegel suggests. Psalms 42 to 49, 84, 85, 87, and 88 are associated with the Korachites, the Levitical choir. These psalms are strikingly original, both in subject matter and poetic skill, and this Korachite group must be appreciated for its daring and initiative, reflected here in unique imagination, as we will see in verse 15, poignant description in verse 12, a multivalent metaphor, verse 6. Psalm 49, a contemplation of the vanity of wealth and the life of death. exceptional within Psalms is less so within the Bible. Yet as many elements of didactic wisdom tradition, wisdom literature, typical of Proverbs and sometimes recalling Ecclesiastes, verse 11. The opening call to take heed recalls Proverbs, as do terms that are often used there and almost never in Psalms. Okay? So, and Proverbs is primarily wisdom tradition. On the other hand, this is the only biblical reference to music with wisdom literature. And the personal note of verse 16 is highly exceptional in such literature. Okay? That's what Rick mentioned. The international scope of Psalm 49 is striking. It's directed to all, not especially to Israel. This is not a prayer God has not addressed and is only mentioned twice in verses 8 and 16. The subject is human, not national, dealing with an observation that might undermine any faith, that is, that riches in this world do not seem to be given to the best people. The psalmist addresses the problem frontally. I do not fear, and you should not fear, says the speaker in verses 6 and 17. Evidently, the term fear reflects existential loss of confidence owing to this observed distribution of wealth. Okay, so as you can see, it's quite exceptional. So there's no full, as I say, no complete explanation why they're called B'nai Korach. The word B'nai, we have mentioned this before, can refer to a group of people who gather perhaps disciples of someone. It could refer to family members, okay? Or there's some sort of designated group. So it's not clear and not clear why Korach has his name associated with this, unless there was somebody else within the Levitical line whose name was Korach. It's possible. And there may have been other traditions about Korach, which we do not know about. Because, you know, there were multiple sources of priests and people who worked in the Mishkan and the temple afterwards, of which we know nothing or very little. Okay, so nobody knows for sure. Okay, so here we go. All right, verse 1, L'matzeach lipnei Korach mizmor, for the leader. Okay, this is the autonomous leader. It's used many times. Menatzeach means the conductor, the choir conductor probably, or the choir and orchestra conductor, because remember, there were musical instruments in the temple. It's very likely that a number of them were used to accompany the choral music, the choral singing.
Rabbi, where exactly are you?
Where do we find a nice list of the musical instruments used in the temple worship? Do you know where you can find it?
Psalm 150.
Psalm 150, says Mike Harris. You are the winner. You get a gold star. Whoopee. Okay, that's right, Psalm 150. Look it over. It's very interesting. We normally sing it, so we don't pay attention to the words. Pay attention to the words. That's something we're learning now, isn't it? Pay attention to the words. They do have meaning. Anyhow, so there you go. So that's the Menatzeach Tibel. It's the anonymous conductor. All right. Shimu zot kol ha'amim ha'azinu kol yoshbei chaled. Hear this, all you peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world. Okay, so there you've got it. All the peoples, all the inhabitants of the world. All right? In fact, this is there's a parallelism. It's an A-B-A-B parallelism. It's not a chiasm. Because if you think about it, there's the A is hear this, the A prime is in the second part, give ear. The B is all the nations, and B prime, all who inhabit the world. So that's a classical structure. We talk about parallelism. This is a very clear parallelism. and it's found frequently in the Psalms. Leon.
Why Chaled instead of Aretz, Kol Yoshevei Aretz?
That's a very good question, and we're going to talk about that word now.
Or Kol Yoshevei Tevel. I've heard that a lot.
Kol Yoshevei Tevel, right. But there must be
at the end of the Kaddish, I think, yeah.
Oh, that's added in. That's the addition.
Right.
The universal prayer, right. Yes. All right, so here's the answer. Leon, did you see my notes?
No, I don't have your notes now.
Oh, you can't. I thought maybe they were reflected in my glasses and you read them out. Backwards.
I have never gotten your notes. If I'm supposed to have them, I'm...
No. All right. So, the word chaled is only is found six times in the Bible. Three times it means word. Okay? Isaiah 38:11 has the word chabel, H-A-D-E-L, chet, dalet, lamed, but it probably should be chaled. So that's one. Psalm 17, verse 14 has another, and Psalm 49, 2. Three times it means a lifespan. Psalm 39, verse 6, Psalm 89, verse 48, and Job 11, 17. So it either means the world or a lifespan. That's it. So, Leon, I can say no more. Now, there are other words that spin off of this. And one of them, I don't we'll see it, it's later on here. There's a name of Huldah, which means a rat. Now, what that has to do with this, I don't know. But it's a very strange word. And the fact is, the fact that the psalmist uses it is a sign of his erudition. And you think about it. And there are psalms we will find frequently that there are words that are very rare embedded in psalms. And it's like, it's part, I think, of the poetic, the art of poetry. Okay, and I see your hand, Tybel. And it reminds me of first Isaiah, because Isaiah as well, the first 39 chapters, the language is very sophisticated. I've said this before. And the words, sometimes you gotta, you come across a word and you start to look it up. And they say, what's this guy talking about? You know, and you find it. I mean, a good lexicon will have it. But very often they're very rare. So it's as if they're using these words because they're trying to make an impression by its uniqueness. Think poetry, right? You use words to create an impact, okay? And so a word that's sort of obscure, people will scratch their head. Ooh, what is this talking about? Well, he's gotten your attention, okay? So it's not surprising. All right, Tybel and then Rick.
So the one of the lesser known of the seven female prophets was Huldah. Is that the same root?
I don't know. I was thinking about that. Of course, she's a Huldah happens to be a very significant prophet, because if you read Second Kings, she tells Josiah he's about to implement the Deuteronomic Code and close down all of the Bamot, all of the unauthorized region or authorized regional shrines, right? And he's going to try to put an end to rampant idolatry of certain kinds. So Huldah says, go ahead and do it. It's a good thing. But it's not going to change the end. The punishment is going to come. That's what she tells him. Read it. Okay, read it. Yeah, strange. Yeah. So anyway, if that has anything to do with her name, I don't know. Okay, who else? Rick.
Yeah, hi. I just have a question. In the Art Scroll that I have, the little book here, It translates Chaled as decaying earth. All you dwellers of decaying earth. And I don't like that a lot. I don't like that very much at all compared to what you said, world or lifespan. But I just thought I'd tell you.
I have not seen that. I looked it up.
Yeah, decaying earth, it says. Hold it's
on,
weird.
Hold on. Haluda is, there. I understand. That's rust, I think.
Haluda?
Yeah. I wish, what's her name right here now?
Fred.
I think Haluda.
Haluda is rust, definitely.
Is what? Rust.
Haluda is rust. Something is Halud, it's rusty.
Right.
That's right. So it could be, maybe that's a connection. I don't know if that word appears in the Bible. I didn't see it. It's interesting. That may have been why they said that. Okay. But sure. It's not in these translations, both of them, that is not, that's not mentioned. And in the Kurler Baumgartner, it's not mentioned either. So I don't know. All right. Moving on. Okay, so but here you see right away, as Rabbi Siegel said, the universal theme is set out immediately, right away, and there's no mention of Am Yisrael in the psalm at all, none. By the way, it's the same in Psalm 145, Ashrei. There's no mention to Bnei Yisrael in that psalm. Now, what you see in the prayer book is different, okay? Because that includes Ashrei really is not the beginning of Psalm 145. Those two lines and the lines at the end are brought from other psalms to make it more Jewish-oriented, because that, too, is a very universal sign. What is the most, the central line that everybody talks? Poteach et yadecha u'matzia l'kol chai ratzon. You open your hand and you satisfy the needs of all living creatures. It's beyond human, right? Now it says karov Adonai l'chol korav l'chol asher yikruhu be'emet, right? God is close to all who call upon him, who call upon him in truth. Yes, it's possible. But, you know, it could refer to people who have Hashem as one of a multitude of gods. But, you know, the point is, it doesn't say specifically for Am Yisrael. The last line, V'anachnu nebarech yameta be'ad olam hallelujah, is from another psalm. And the anachnu, of course, refers to us. Because as far as we know, we're the only people saying that when we daven. Right, normal people or non-Jews, let's say, who read the Psalms, see Psalm 145. So that's added in. Anachnu means us, and us is the Jewish people. Okay, so that was added in. That's another quite a universal psalm. So these exist, but here it's really very, very pointed. Okay, here we go. So he's continuing. Who he's still beginning his address, right? So he's continuing. Because if you look at the translation, after the word world is a comma, because it really can, this is another, I'm using this term now that I learned, a dyad, right, where two verses exist and they are intended to be, in a sense, linked together. Okay? All right, so now, Gam b'nei Adam, Gam b'nei Ish, Yachad Ashir ve'Evyon. Okay, men as well as persons. Interesting. That's Siegel. And then the JPS is men of all estates. Okay, but either way, it's talking about rich and then rich and poor alike. So it's doing two things. What is this Bnei Adam and Bnei Ish? So Siegel suggests that there is a kind of a differentiation between status classes here, okay? And Bnei Adam and Bnei Ish may have been in the mind of the poet, two different kinds of people. We don't know for a fact. But what you still, but the point is, one would suggest there may be some kind of a contrast between B'nai Adam and B'nai Ish, because the second part says, Yachad Ashir Ve'Evyon, poor, rich, poor and rich alike. And there is a contrast. So if you say, well, that contrast should appear in the first part of the verse, then it would be people of different status. So that's how you would think that. But it's interesting that you have this repetition, B'nai Adam and B'nai Ish. It's hard to know exactly what he had. Okay, Rick.
Yeah, I want to support your idea there. Again, the art scroll, it says the term sons of man refers to people who can trace their ancestry back to men of distinction and thus derive social and financial advantage. The sons of Adam include the vast majority of humans who lack any pedigree except that Adam was their forebear. So, this is from Rabbi Hirsch. The message of this psalm is of equal importance to both, right, is what he said.
That is correct. So, no question. That's good. Yeah. I mean, Siegel suggests that as well. He may be aware of Hirsch on that. I don't know. But yes. Yeah, that's saying the same thing. Thank you. That's good. I feel affirmed. Oh, you made my day. Although God spoke to me before, so I mean, what can I say?
Okay. I try to help.
That's okay. All right. Now, but again, this is a foreshadowing. The fact that he introduces a differential between economic classes, okay, is now pointing. It's not just universal. But it's pointing to the major theme that he's going to develop, wealthy and poor, right? Which is going to be included denunciation of wealth as a guarantee of ultimate happiness, okay? And in that respect, rich and poor are alike. Everybody is going to die, and wealth makes no difference. So it's possible he's already setting that up by laying it out right now, and that may give strength to what the art scroll was saying, and what Siegel was saying, is that they're talking about different upper and lower classes in Adam and Ish. Mike, did you have your hand up? No? Okay. All right. Moving on. Pi yedaber chokmot v'hagut libi tvunot. My mouth speaks wisdom. The utterance of my heart, understanding. That's Siegel. Okay. Now the JPS it pushes on this. I don't like it. My mouth utters wisdom. Yes. My speech is full of insight. Hagutli be. Okay. But I think utterance is a better usage here. The utterance of my heart, because it's not necessarily speech, or it's more than speech. It's speech plus. It's something. It is a less more obscure expression, because ultimately, if it comes from the heart, it's not coming from the vocal cords, right? It's coming. Yes, the vocal cords express them, but ultimately, it's coming from a higher place within us. So utterance, I think, is a little better term. I'm even suggesting there's another meaning to hagut, which is musing, the thoughts, the concepts that are in my head. Okay? All right, so this expresses what the chokhmot are in the first part. So it's a joint effort between heart and body as these are being expressed. I like that word, though, hagut lev, in its obscurity or in its potential for multiple interpretations. That's good poetry. Okay, Leon.
I was just going to say that the author agrees with you. He also translates the same way, the utterance of my heart understanding.
Yeah, well, that's Benji Siegel as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I like that. That's a good term, better than speech. Speech is too cut and dry. Okay. Now, wisdom. So this is now what Benji's suggesting, Benji Siegel. Literally, wisdom and understanding are in the plural. Notice, it doesn't say chokhmah and tevunah. It's chokhmot and tevunot. Possibly an emphasis.
And hagut.
And what?
And hagut also.
Yeah, hagut is also, that's good. Well, no. That's not hagut, it's hagut. No, that's a singular.
Oh.
The plural will be hagutot or haguot. Add an aleph in there. No, that's a singular. But chokhmot.
Because Art Scroll defines it as meditations, not meditation.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
No. That it's not a plural word.
Yeah.
Meditations is good. No, I mean I like the concept of meditation. Yes. Okay. Yes. But I think the plurals here are maybe highlighting the significance of what he's going to say. Okay. It's very, very important. In other words, it is not simple. It's not simple one word or simple concept. He's saying this is deep knowledge, deep wisdom, profound wisdom, like the depths, plural, of wisdom.
And it's wisdom for everyone. I mean, it's big.
Yeah. That's right.
Big in size and big in depth.
That's right. In other words, he's been talking plurals all along, right? Rich and poor, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And so similarly, there are multiple levels of wisdom here. And so therefore, it's important that people listen to him. As Siegel says, it's for emphasis. What I'm about to tell you is not just simple wisdom. It's deep. It's important wisdom. So pay close attention. It's almost as if he knows he's going to say some very stark things. Very stark. Very strong. Okay, Leon.
Even Ezra says, Hege libi, shehege libi. And I think that's very interesting. That the directioning of my heart, you know, it's like a hege of the car.
Yes, that's right. That's not, oh, that's very interesting.
You know?
Yeah, that's interesting. The direction.
Kind of beautiful.
Yeah, that is. So great. You see how many different meanings we find in these words. That's wonderful poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And he's right. It speaks to so many different people in different ways. Very good. All right. Now, and here's this line about music. Okay, verse 5. Ate lemashal ozni eftach. Bechinor chidati. Okay. I will incline my ear to a proverb. Now, JPS has turned my attention, but I like ete lemashal, osni. I like forth, incline my ear. That's great. That's Siegel. I like that because that's what it means. I like sometimes, you know, very often he tries to stick to the literal meaning. And very often, the literal meaning provides us with an impact that a modern expression wouldn't give. Because when you know, it's like this: I incline my ear, right? When you do this, when do you do this? When it's something you want to hear, right? So he's inclining his ear, okay, to a proverb, in other words, to wisdom. Then it says, "And I will set forth my exposition with a lyre." L-Y-R-E. Remember, a kinnor is not a harp; it's a lyre. Okay, it's a small instrument, easily mobile. Okay, all right. A tybal.
And maybe I thought of this because this is the psalm for mourning, but it wouldn't work if someone died very young. The other time when someone inclines their ear is if they're getting older and experiencing age-related changes in hearing.
Yes.
So you have to incline your, so there's that sense of life cycle then embedded possibly. Not necessarily to the parable part. Maybe though, maybe the older people get, the more willing they are to listen. But the incline my ear, I thought of hearing one.
Yeah, it could be. On the other hand, it could be, it could refer to the subtlety of what is going on too. In other words, that these are, you need to listen closely to what he's saying. Okay, he needs to listen closely to the wisdom that he's going to share, and we have to listen closely to it because it's that important. Hence the inclination of the ear. Now, I know firsthand what it's like for people who are more advanced in years to have to incline the ear. I am hearing impaired, so I'm one of the ear incliners. You never heard that before. I'm opening up a new society. The Ear Incliner Society. Anybody want to join? The membership is very simple. Say, speak louder. Okay.
Gray hair.
That too. Bert.
Oh, I just noticed that in verses 3 through 5 are all in groups of 3 words, which adds to the poetry of it.
Oh.
Right, verse 3 is 2 groups of 3 words, and then...
I didn't notice this, but you know something that I don't? Oh my goodness, what chutzpah.
I can count.
Well, it's interesting, because even verse 2, okay, well, that's 4 and 4.
4 and 4.
It's the same number, though. Yes. And then 3 is 3, 3, and 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, and that's verse 3. 3 times 3. And then verse 4, 3 and 3. And verse 5, 3 and 3. Then not verse 6. That's 4 and 3. But that's very, very interesting.
Of course, these were not numbered when it was written.
No, but doesn't
yeah.
It doesn't matter because...
Right, no, but it's a group. It has a very poetic feel to it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And they all have to do with the threes. 3, 3, 3. But in particular, 4 and 5 are all the context in the context of wisdom. Right? They're all dealing with expressions of wisdom. Chokhmah, Vuna, Chida, these are all wisdom-associated words. Now, Chida today is a riddle or joke, but it's almost a bastardizing of the word, as you can see here. It has a much more... Now, Chidati, it's interesting, the old Brown Drive, BDB, the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, suggests that Chidati means solution, a solution, as opposed to exposition. Right? Or a lesson. Interesting. Solution. It's very interesting. And mashal is a proverb here. It fits in the translation. See, it's interesting. The APS has a theme, which is more general. But when it says, when Benji Siegel says a proverb, he's being very specific because, again, this is all being expressed within the context of wisdom teaching. That proverb is a key, is a you know, very prominent concept when you come to wisdom. And you got to realize this is being taught this within these wisdom traditions. This is high level stuff. And on the one hand, it deals with all kinds of things. But the teacher of wisdom was a very significant teacher in these ancient. All right. Now, then he goes on. Now, by the way, I'll say this again in a moment later. Most commentators end the first part at the end of verse 5, and they see verses 6 and 7 as attached to what follows. Okay? I'm an outlier on this one. And by the Siegel, and the JPS are in agreement on that. I'm an outlier. I think that these are all part of the introduction when the teacher is speaking. And you know it is he, because he's speaking first person. And six and seven are like another, it's another dyad, as you will see, whether you put it before, where you say it's the beginning of the new part or the end of the first part. It's a dyad. But the point is, there's a link between the two. So verse six, continues the speech of the teacher. Look what it says. Lama ira b'yamei ra avon akevai yisabu yisubani. Okay. Why should I fear in days of evil, the evil that, or the crime that surrounds me at my heel? Now, again, Benji is taking the word akev, literally. Where do we find that word?
Yaakov, right? Yeah,
exactly. Yaakov was holding on to akev Esau.
But the serpent also.
Huh?
The serpent.
Yeah. Yes.
It'll bite your heel. And I think that that's what my translator translates it as. When crime comes around at my heels.
Yes. Yes. But here, yeah, well, that's Benji Siegel also. I like that. JPS says, the encompassing evil of those who would supplant me. That loses its impact. We're talking about biting a heel. You're talking about the snake. You know, that's a good point. Yes. So anyway, why should I fear these days? And listen, here's poetry. Lama ira b'yamei ra. Ira, ra. Now, ira is with an olive, right? But still the sound. You hear it, right? Lama ira b'yamei ra. Why shall I fear days that are filled with evil? Okay? And he's going to continue to talk about what that is in the next line. And then the sins, the crime that surround. Now here, avon akev, akevai, avon akevai. There's three ayin words in the row. Ra, avon, akevai. Now you say, big whoopee, what difference does that make? But you realize that an ayin has a unique sound to it. It's not the same as an olive. It's what we understand, it's a guttural sound. It's the ayin. Ayin. Right? So it should be said properly as we understand what this is. It would be the yame ra avon akevai. Right? You can gag on that if you don't know how to do it. Okay? But I mean, it's the sounds here. You'll see the same thing, for example, in the Song of the Sea, Az Yashir. There are many places in there where you have this assonance and alliteration of these letters that look alike and sounds that sound alike. It's a real, it's used in poetry throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia, right? You see it in modern poetry, right? The tintinabulation of, that's different. But that word, the word tintinabulation even, right? It's an onomatopoeic word. It picks up on the sound of the bells, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, or ding-ding-ding, whatever, you know. All right. Anyhow, so let's continue reading this then, and then we'll talk about it. Habotchim al chelam uverov oshram yithalal. These are people who trust in their wealth, and in the to take glory in their wealth. All right, Benjamin says increased riches. But either way, but the point is, these are people. Boteach chel is the key word here, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But again, this is a chiasm. Okay, A is habotchim, A prime at the end is Yithalalu. Teilam and Oshram in the middle are the other parallels. So it's an A, B, B, A. It's a classic chiasm. Before we saw an A, B, A, B. This is an A, B, B, A. Poetry, right? Again, the use of that. But again, this very often they will use the chiasm to create an impact. And it's like a neon sign saying, this is the issue, guys. This is the issue. People think that they have their wealth is the key to eternal life. Okay? And that's the problem, because look what he says. Go back to verse 6. These are the people who are biting at his heels. This is the evil to which he refers in verse 6. And this is, it's agreed upon by the translators, whether you attach it to what came before or attach it to what comes after. And this is a statement of the basic premise here, that evil, that wealth is associated with evil. Okay, we'll talk about that in just a second. Let me finish it up, Bert. Hold on. It's reminiscent of a line in the Gospels. You know about it, right? It's easier to fit a camel through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven. The same idea. That's using different metaphors, right? Same idea. Because if a rich man can't get into heaven, why? Because they're intrinsically evil. That's what it says. Think about it. And it's harder for a guy to get into heaven than it is to get a camel in the eye of a needle. This is really a reductio ad absurdum, but it makes the point. And this is, in a sense, the same way. That's the evil that's referred to in verse 6. And he's not afraid of it. Why is he not afraid? For that, we have to wait till verse 16. Not going to tell you now. Okay, Bert.
I'm going really from the meaning of the English, because I'm not that fluent in the depth of the Hebrew. But it seems to me this is, I don't read this as being against wealth. It's against trust in wealth. It's against glory in wealth. And I think that's a very big difference between the Jewish tradition and the Christian one. In the Christian, you have asceticism, and in Judaism, isn't it so that it's a sin to not take advantage of something you could? But yeah. At least in the English, it's the trust in the riches and the glory in the wealth, not the, you could be, I guess, wealthy and righteous.
Yeah,
or am I misunderstanding it?
No, you're partially right, I think.
Okay.
But is glorying in wealth, upon whom does the glory shine?
Mm-hmm.
On you.
Right, yeah.
Not trust.
Well, and you're glorying in wealth instead of glorying in God.
Well, but the point doesn't matter. Well, yeah, it's a problem. Yeah, that is a problem. You'll see somewhere we'll talk about that. That wealth can impede your faith in God. Yes, but the point is, if you're praising yourself, who's the source of your wealth? You are. That's what glorying, yitalalu, it's a yitpael form, it's reflexive. Bouncing back on the person who acts that way. So that's why boteach is not simply the notion of, you know, trusting in a kind of a innocent or whatever way. The impact of this verse is that's evil. Okay? And as the suggestion is, I think, is the same notion that ultimately wealth and evil. Then that's what's so strange about this verse. I mean, the denigration of wealthy people in this verse, that's what we said at the outset. Siegel mentioned that in his introduction. It's quite unique. You're right, Bert. Generally speaking, Judaism is not opposed to wealth, but it's opposed to ill-gotten wealth.
Well, right.
And it's opposed to wealth that is which is wrapped up in the sense of power that an individual has for themselves.
Worship of the wealth, worship of the golden calf. I mean,
yes, exactly. And that's evil. because it can interfere with your faith in God. And I'll show you, we're going to get to a statement that does that. It says it quite explicitly. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, doesn't it also, though, kind of throw out the notion of, you know, you can't take it with you?
Yes.
That's the main message.
Right. So you can boast about having a whole bunch of stuff, but it doesn't matter because you ain't going to take it with you regardless.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's why, remember what I said last week. It's the old adage. You never see a hearse following a funeral coach. I'm sorry. You never see a hearse followed by a Brinks truck. Right. You never see a hearse followed by a Brinks truck. Remember Brinks, armored trucks, money, right? They don't go together because you can't take it with you. Okay, that's exactly the point. Yes. All right. Rick, did you want to say something or you pulled it down?
Well, I was just going to throw out that I'm noticing that the Chet and the Lamed and the Dalet keeps repeating. We had the Chaled. And then we had the kind of the sound with the chidati, and here we have chelam in verse 7, and we have chadal coming up in verse 9. So the poet is using the same sounds. You're bringing my attention to the sounds of things. So
exactly,
I think there's a purpose to that.
Siegel mentions that. Yes. So you're in the same boat as my friend, Rabbi Dr. Siegel. Yes.
And the Yitalalu should be towards God, but it's towards the person that's so proud of themselves that they have all the money. But the Halalu isn't directed the right way, right?
Well, it's Hallelujah me. Hallelujah me. Be praised me, not Hallelujah. And that's evil. That in and of itself is evil. And that's what wealth does. Okay. All right. Tybel.
If it's okay, just a fast comment that I kept thinking about. For people who do genealogy, you spend some time learning about Mormon theology. And part of the theology, at least for the main Latter-day Saint Church, is that if you're a person who has wealth on earth, it's a sign that you're a good person. I mean, it's just in a way the opposite of the camel through the eye. Yes, you're supposed to tithe. What you're supposed to do with it is tithe to the church and do all those things. But it's just very interesting the different ways theology comes out.
Right. Doesn't Calvinism state that if you're wealthy, it's a sign of divine blessing? I've heard that they justify it in that way.
A lot of wealthy people say that.
Yes, I know. Leon, I can't. You got on mute.
I'm talking to myself. Malvin talks about habotchim al chelam velo yiftechu bo lihiot emtsai ela shlemut. Bimkom tzedaka v'chesed. In other words, they look on wealth as being the end goal instead of being an emtsai, a methodology to produce tzedaka v'chesed.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about that. But
that's why I brought it up. I didn't think about it either.
End result: the goal is not going to be that. You can think that, but it ain't going to keep you out of dying and going down below.
Right. Well, tzedakah v'chesed will, right? Because shezeh ma'avir et ro'a mazal.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes. Well, that's very nice. That's good. I mean, I don't know the shot, but the point is, because chel means power, wealth, power. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, but that's very interesting. From a moral perspective, that's very interesting. All right. Unless I have some comment. All right, so I told you that this is a chiasm. All right, now, in verse 7, I'm reading my notes, okay, so you'll pardon me if I don't look you in the eye. In verse 7, wealth is expressed with two different words, chelam and oshram, okay? Ashram is the same as Ashir in verse 3. All right. And this is the most commonly used word for wealth, Osher, wealthy, right? Osher. You always say, may you have Osher va'Osher, right? Osher is good fortune with an Aleph, and Osher is wealth.
Osher with Ayin.
Yeah. All right.
And Osher v'chavod is in the prayer book someplace, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So chelam is the Hebrew word chayil, chet yud lamed. There's another word, chil, which means pain, like chil kayoleda, pangs of birth. But chayil has many meanings. Wealth, power, success, and bravery. And we
that is chayil.
We know exactly. Hold on. Yes, I'll give you examples. So we say eshet chayil, a successful woman.
I thought it was a woman of valor.
That means a successful woman.
So it doesn't mean a rich broad that I married?
Yes. No, read it. No, there's no question. The Eshet Chayil and her husband are wealthy people. She buys and sells land. She has her own garment business, okay? And the people who meet at the gate, who are the men who run the community, know about her from her deeds. Read that piece of Proverbs, the last verses of Proverbs. Exactly. She's a successful person. That's an Eshet Chayil, a competent person. Yes. So it's not a woman of valor. But valor is bravery. That doesn't speak of bravery. It talks of power, success, independence, right? And she takes care of her husband and the kids. But they also are proud of her because of her achievements. That's what the end of that says. So that's a very, very, definitely. All right, anyway. So chayil means successful. Shetelech mechayil el chayil, right? May you go from strength to strength. So there we use that term all the time. Okay, so strength. So I suggest that the author's use of this term, in addition to the poetry of the chiasm, is to set the stage for the denunciation of wealth as a power that allows a wealthy person the ability to overcome death and destruction. Okay? So he's using that word specifically because it carries with it many of the self-definitions that these wealthy people have about what they can do.
In here, isn't chaylam is more possessions, not that they have value to them, but that they're talking about the possessions.
Yes, Oshram, theirs. Ah, good. Yes, something that they have done. Exactly. Yes, very good. That leads nicely into what I'm now going to point to your attention. And here's what he's doing. He's sort of sarcastically scoffing at this. Okay. Now, open your Bible, please. Or turn pages now to Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 11 to 20. It's a big chunk, but I think it's important that we read this because I think you'll see an echo of one here in the other, whether they are written with one or the other in the mind, in the mind of the authors, I don't know. All right, but this is a very famous part of Devarim.
Please say the chapter and verses again, Rabbi.
Chapter 8 in Devarim, Deuteronomy, verses 11 to 20. All right, I'm going to read through the preliminary stuff. Just, if you have, I'll read the Hebrew and the English. All right, but then when we get closer to the main point I want to show you, we'll spend some time. So, Hishamer lecha, pen tishkachet Adonai Elohecha lebilti, Shmor mitzvotav u'mitzvotav v'chukotav asher anochi mitzavcha hayom. Take care lest you forget your God Adonai and fail to keep the divine commandments, rules, and laws which I enjoin upon you today. Pen tochal v'sabata u'batim tovim tibneh v'yashavta. When you have eaten your fill and if you have built fine houses to live in, u'b'korcha v'tzoncha Yeribun, v'chesef v'zahav yirbelach, v'chol asher lecha yirbeh. When your herds and flocks have multiplied, and your silver and gold have increased, and everything you own has prospered, v'ram levavcha v'shachachta et Adonai Elohecha ha-motziacha me'eretz Mitzrayim v'beit Avadim. Beware lest your heart grow haughty and you forget your God Adonai, who freed you from the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. So here it is. Wealth interferes with your worship and recognition of God, because we'll see why in a minute. Hamolichcha b'midbar gadol v'nora. Nachash. Usaraf is my, I'm sorry, the printing here stuck the words together. Nachash saraf ve'akrav v'tzim'on asher ein mayim, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its seraph serpents and scorpions, a parched land with no water in it, who brought forth water for you from the flinty rock. Hamalchicha min hamidbar, man, excuse me, hamalchicha man bamidbar, Asher lo yadun avotecha, laman anotcha, laman sotecha, ulehitivcha be'acharitecha, who fed you in the wilderness with manna which your ancestors had never known, in order to test you by hardships, only to benefit you in the end. Now here's the key verse. Ve'amarta bilvavcha, Kochi ve'otzem yadi asali et hachayil hazeh. There it is. And you say to yourselves, my own power and the might of my own hand have won this wealth for me. There it is. You see? And that's what I think, that's what the psalmist is talking about. Now, what does this do to your faith in God? It goes on. And I'm making an association here, just by the fact that it continues in this direction. Now, there's a space in the Torah there. It's the end of the paragraph. But I think the thought continues now. And you have to keep this, what's coming up, in mind. Okay? Now, I skip verse 18. This is what you should be doing instead. Remember God, because you're God, because he's the one who gives you the strength to make all this wealth. Laman hakim et brito asher nishba lavotecha kayom hazeh. In order that you fulfill the covenant with your ancestors as you do this day. The day being the day when Moses' Torah is going to be taught to the people. Okay? All right, now. V'hayayim shachoch tishkach ad Adonai Elohecha. And it happens, and so if you do forget God Adonai and follow other gods, halakha acharei Elohim acherim v'avadatam v'ishtachavita lahem, heidoti bachem hayom ki avod tovei dun. If you do forget Adonai and follow other gods and serve them or bow down to them, I warn you this day that you shall certainly perish. Kagoyim asher v'nai ma'avid mipnechem kein tovei dun ekev lo tishma'un b'kol Adonai Eloheichem. If you do forget God and follow other gods to serve them or bow down to them, I warn you this day, you shall certainly perish. Oh, I just said that. Sorry. That's the previous verse translated. Here we go. Like the nations that Adonai will cause to perish before you, so you shall perish because you did not heed your God Adonai. Okay? So this, it's a similar statement. And the number, the reason why I ended it there and not earlier is because I think that this is what it basically is the result. The worship of yourself as a God ultimately opens you up to the worship of many gods, because in either case, you are forgetting the one God. That's what this is saying. And that's the evil associated with wealth, right? The fact that you believe in yourself and make yourself into a God with power. Okay, so fine, I'm like all these other gods. Where's Hashem in the picture? Oh, him. I forgot. It's what Deuteronomy is saying is belief in a God that is not natural, that's not like you. Belief in a God that's different, like non-human, non-material, invisible, is a hard thing. And that's why you got to work at it. And it's right. We've talked about this before. We are material individuals, so we're easier very often, you know, to believe in something physical. And this is saying no. Your belief in yourself as a physical being opens the door to belief in gods who are physical beings or who will manifest in the powers of nature through physical expressions. That's not the God, the true God. Remember, Deuteronomy is the most anti-pagan book in the Torah, unabashedly so. This theme is over and over. It becomes boring after. But Zenosha's got to drum it into the heads of physical humans who have strong tendencies to go in the other direction, which is what the psalm is saying. Wealth is seductive like paganism. And in both instances, Hashem goes out the door. Rick.
I really like that you chose this section, because when you were talking about Yaakov and the heel and all that and Akev, I thought of the Torah reading Akev. And so I looked at the beginning of it. It's chapter 7, 12. And there in the Eitz Chaim, it has Akev literally on the heels of, or as a consequence of. And then when we get to verse 20, you have Akev again, and there that translates it as because you. So it's a consequence of you not listening, lo tishma'un. So I like that a lot. And then the very next verse, you have an echo of the Shema Yisrael. So if you listen, it'll be okay. If you don't listen, it's not going to be so good.
Right.
So I like that a lot.
But it ends up making the same statement the Psalm does. You're going to die. You will be destroyed. He's speaking of a nation. But basically, it's the same. Psalm says, all your wealth. The difference is that the psalmist doesn't push faith in God as much. There's mentions made of God, too. We said that. You'll see them. Well, you've seen one. Anyway, but there's a different thrust here. The psalmist is more interested in the actions of people and the attitude of these wealthy people. And he doesn't connect it as much to the interference between that and faith in God. He doesn't develop it the way Deuteronomy does. Okay? And that's the wisdom approach. And Deuteronomy is much more, I would say, fully developed in this whole concept than what's found here. But the psalm, nonetheless, is expressing these things more categorically, because basically the psalmist has said wealth is bad. Deuteronomy allows for the fact wealth is okay as long as you recognize God as the source of wealth. That's fine. You can be wealthy. Where the psalmist is so vibrant in his criticism of wealth that he doesn't even make that. He doesn't allow for that. He doesn't say that. All right, Bert. Can't hear you.
Sorry, one of the more interesting interpretations I've read of the first line of the priestly blessing, Yivarecha Ananavi Yishmarecha, is may God bless you with material things and protect you from the possible effect of those material things, although that's earlier in the Torah.
Right. No, but there is a tradition that views it as focusing on material as well as other kinds of blessings. But it's saying is you got to keep the right focus. So that's good. Yeah, that's very good.
And there's also, I forget, in Deuteronomy, that line says God takes no bribes.
Yes.
Meaning that your money is not going to take you up to heaven. It's also amazing when you consider these were written thousands of years ago, and in some ways how little things have changed in terms of human nature and the challenges of wealth.
Absolutely. and sometimes you see this outpouring of anger, disappointment, because of the people catering to this physical stuff and overblowing its significance. And when it comes to this notion, I am like God because I am wealthy. This notion that you have abandoned God in the process. That's bad stuff. Okay, moving on. Let's see what time it is. Okay, we got about 12 minutes left. Good. So, all right. So I'm going to suggest then that verse 7 refers to the cause of the evil crime noted in verse 6. And the chiasm is a blinking neon light associated with wealth with evil. And in verse 6, the psalmist is saying this evil activity does not frighten him. So as I said, the 6 and 7 are a dyad. The translators agree with me because there's a comma between 6 and 7, not a period. Okay. Now here's the thing. The author no longer shifts verse 7. The author is shifting. And I think this is a transitional verse to the second part. Because remember, I'm a guy who plugs this stuff up into the first part. All right? And I have a slightly different reading of what's going to start now. So the author no longer shares how he feels. He shifts to what he believes to be the existential reality, which is the way these wealthy people think. Okay? All of which in the balance of the psalm, like verse 7, is expressed in third person. Everything from this point on is third person. He doesn't say me, my, whatever, as he does in the first part. He doesn't address you, the audience to whom he's speaking. It's all third person, which in a sense is removing him. He's now describing the reality of what's going to happen. He's stepping back, right? When you teach and you speak to the you, right, you are relating to that. Here in this, starting now at the second part in the verse 7, he's stepping back from what he is teaching to now what he is observing and what the results of his observations, alluded to already, are going to be. Okay, so that's the shift. So that's why I think this is still part of the first part. Okay, all right. Now, part two. Okay, let's see. Well, we got time. Well, let's go ahead. Good. All right, in part two, we'll explain why such people cannot buy their way out of Sheol, Shachat. Okay, now Sheol is the term that's going to pop up a little bit later, and then Shachat is going to appear a little bit later. Sheol is sort of the communal grave in which people spend eternity, okay? The word is found in Jacob's words in Genesis chapter 37, which we will read in a moment. By the way, Jacob's words in Genesis 37 is the first time that this word Sheol, which is a powerful force in the Bible, this is the first time that it's mentioned, Jacob's words to his sons. In the Bible, it's used 65 times, of which 16 times are in the Psalms. So Psalms like this concept. All right. Now, I have a question for you. I said three things. This is the first time it's mentioned in the Bible, in Jacob, right, in Genesis chapter 37. First time mentioned in the Bible, mentioned 65 times, 16 times are in the Psalms. How do I know these tidbits of information?
Because you looked in your beloved dictionary in concordance.
Ah, say the last word again.
Concordance.
A concordance. Yes. I've done this before. I shall do it again. The concordance. The concordance. Four. Okay. The concordance. What is the concordance? It is a listing of every single word in the Bible organized on the basis of the meaning of the words. So I just counted how many times. I don't have to because they're numbered. So this number, the number of the verses that are listed, and here goes from 1 to 65. I could find, I've seen counts that go up to 1,000. You know, some of the word, important words or little words or whatever, you know, or more. Okay. So this is where you find it. And, you know, to me, it's one of the most basic tools that I use whenever I read things. I'm a bean counter, if you've noticed. I love to count. And, you know, I can say that Rick has learned how to do this as well. You count the number of times the words appear.
He is an expert. I will vouch for that.
Yes, that says something. Okay, that says something. Now, I don't keep all this information in my head. Can't do it. Don't have to. I got four volumes right there. And you know, they're good. They're nice volumes. They make you good for your arm strength. You know, you can put two of them together. You can put all four of them together. And you're in great shape. Okay? You build your physical as well as your spiritualist. It's amazing. It's a gift from God. Okay, that's the concordance. Okay?
It helped you again?
You should know it exists.
Kodesh Baruch Hu helped you again, not only with the computer?
Right. I used, computers, no. You can find it. I don't know if there's a biblical concordance in Hebrew on the computer. There must be. But I like here because I can control more easily and see more easily what I'm looking for because I can count. I have to sit at the computer and start counting numbers. No, here, it's right here. I put on my reading glasses and everything flows. It's good to have. These are good books. All right, Tybel.
I'm so sorry that I didn't follow this, but when you talk about Bereishis 37 and Sheol, unless it's not Sheol, I think Yosef. I don't think Yaakov.
I'll get to it right now. Let's turn, please, the Bible to Genesis.
It's verse 35.
Thanks, Rick. You blow it, Jim and me. I was going to surprise everybody. Oh, my God. Genesis 37. I'm joking. You know that.
Yeah, I know. Verses it is related to Joseph.
31 to 35. It's part of the story of Joseph, yes. But here's what it says. All right. You ready? 31. Here we go. So, vayikhu et ketonet Yosef, vayishchatu seir izim, vayitbalu et akutonet badam. So they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a kid. Now, this is not a little child. This is a goat.
Yes.
You do not do the other thing. All right. And dipped the tunic in the blood. Vayishchatu et ketonet apasim, Vayaviyuhu el avihem, vayomru zot matzanu, hakerna, hakutonet binchahi imlo. So they had the ornamented tunic taken to their father, and they said, "We found this. Please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not?" By the way, and this is relating more to the where we are now in the Bible 101 class, for those of you who are taking Bible 101, the kutonet pasim, that term referring to a coat of an ornamented tunic, commonly called a cloak of many colors, but an ornamented tunic is probably the correct way, is found only five times in the Bible, five times the entire Bible. And on only two locations, in only two chapters, Genesis 37:3, 23, and 32, which is what we just read. That's regarding Jacob's son Joseph's garment. And 2 Samuel 13, 18, and 19, which is David's daughter Tamar. So the children, Jacob's child and David's child, are the only two people in the entire Bible who had an ornamented tunic, okay? That's not to be confused with gin and tonic. That's something else. All right, now, Vayakira, Vayomer, Ketonet Bini, Chayara'a Achaltuhu, Tarof, Torof, Yosef. He recognized it and said, my son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast. Vayikra Yaakov Simlotav, Vayasim Sak B'matnotav, B'matnav, Vayitabel Albano Yamim Rabin. Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for his sons many days. Vayakum Kol Banav V'chol B'notav L'nachamo, Vayimayin Lehitnachem, Vayomer Ki Ered El B'ni Avel She'ola, Vayefk Oto Aviv. All his sons and daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, saying, no, I will go down mourning to my son in Sheol. And all his sons and daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted because he said that. His father bewailed him. Okay? So, this is Sheol. What's interesting is this. The word Sheol, this is the earliest reference to it in terms of the different parts of the Torah. It's a J tradition, which could be anywhere, not around 900 BCE, give or take. Okay? So it's probably the oldest of the redacted statements. All right? And it was used, based upon my reading in the concordance, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, he refers to it. That is around, it's the middle of the 3rd century BCE. Most scholars assume that Kohelet was written sometime during that first century of Hellenistic contact in Eretz Yisrael. So that's a term that was operative as a description of where people go when they die. It is it's down below, and you stay there forever. That's it. That's the end. And that's the point that our author will be making when we return to this next week. Okay? All right. Do never, at Tybel, you shouldn't ask a question at the end of class. But for you, I'll make an exception. Go ahead.
Well, it's actually not a question. It's an old person's fun fact, which has to do with, because you said what you said about Osher, and the meaning. And you know the doubled masculine name, Osher Zelig, which is Hebrew, then Yiddish. So decades ago, there is still, I think he's still alive, a psychologist at Penn named Martin Seligman, who started studying the psychology of happiness. And I remember when I learned that, I thought, oh yeah, because his name is Seligman, which means happy. What else is he going to study? Well, Osher, the Hebrew, very big in my part of the United States. I just looked quickly. I think there are some near you, but Bernard Osher, a Maine guy who made a lot of money, founded these things called Osher Lifelong Learning, sometimes called Ollie, but his name is Osher, which I'm used to thinking of the happy, fortunate meaning, but it's also the wealthy meaning. And that's just my fun fact that sometimes people's names really are significant. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Random fun facts.
Right. Well, I'll accept that. My name is Yisrael, right? And according to Torah, it means he wrestled with God. I wrestle with God all the time.
You're not Yoel?
No, I'm not Yoel. I'm Yisrael Yaakov.
Huh.
I have friends, members of the synagogue called Joel, and they're not Yoel either. So, you know, what can I tell you?
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.